This meeting is now being recorded.
It's Greg in Miami, Ground Zero.
Thank you, Greg. Who else?
Red Lake City.
Red Lake, nice.
You're welcome.
Morning, once you say your name and city, please go ahead and mute your line.
We mute.
Yes, star 7.
Not muted, we can hear you.
Muted.
Who else just joined?
Yes.
I get your name and city, and before we start our last minute arrival.
Okay.
That's the number.
Last few people, try and get the name and city, and before we start, before we mute everybody.
Everybody
here?
Yep.
25 in Madison. Nice work. We're raising the bar back there, people.
Hi, Mark. It's Lisa from Albuquerque.
Great, Lisa. Thank you. Loud and clear. Gotcha.
All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing star 6.
All right, well, welcome, everybody. Susan, if you could hit the star 39 to get rid of the beeps, that would be great. Welcome to the September Citizens Climate Lobby call. My name is Mark Reynolds. I'll be hosting the call, and I will be introducing our guest, Jerry Taylor, momentarily, who is someone that has been requested by multiple people, so we're very excited that we could finally get him on. If you're new to this call, there are three things that we do every month. One is we educate ourselves, and so every month we try and get at this issue from a different angle so that we want to come away every single month feeling like we have a little additional capacity to deal with the issue, whether that's from a scientist or an economist or people that have different ways of viewing this issue. We just want to make sure that we have expanded ourselves every month. We also practice every month, so we provide laser talks so that not only do we have a broader understanding, but we feel like we're more articulate, better able, more effective at communicating. And then the third and probably most important thing is that we remain in action and in very focused action. We're committed to proving that there can be a successful relationship between citizens and elected officials. And if you ask, you know, what is an effective relationship between citizens and an elected official, let me just cite one very recent example from Alaska. So last year, we had quite a bit of success getting the REMI report in front of members of the House and Senate. And what it showed was the potentially stimulative effect of cycling billions of dollars in the economy if you had a steadily rising fee on carbon and you sent that back as a monthly dividend. Well, in the meetings with Senator Murkowski of Alaska, what she said is, okay, your modeling is regional, Alaska's unique, and energy use is really high, particularly in rural Alaska. How can you expect me to support something like this if it's going to hurt my constituents? So what the Alaskans went to do is they went to work looking for someone who could perform a study on what impact would our policy proposal have specifically in the rural parts of Alaska. They found an academic who could do the work. They raised the money. They commissioned the report, and he published it recently. And so several really fantastic things have happened. One is we were doing what we always want to be, which is a resource to Congress to help them solve big problems. Two, we're providing information to Senator Murkowski so that she can go to her constituents and say, listen, I looked at this proposal, I wanted to make sure it didn't hurt Alaskans, and here's what we found out about how this can actually help Alaskans. I'm not saying Senator Murkowski has promised to introduce anything or that she's even read the proposal, the report yet. I know some of her staff has. But then let's look at a couple of other things that happen from this. So if you're an academic, for the gentleman who wrote this report, for you to stay employed, you have to publish. So we gave him an opportunity to get published, and in addition to that, we've already generated media around that piece. So once you publish, and if there's media generated, and we'll generate, as you know, a lot more media in addition to what was already generated, that gives him a lot of credibility in his industry. So what I think that does for us is what often happens. One chapter kind of sets a trail and says, here's what we saw, the unique challenge, here's how we answered it, and then it gives a lot of our other chapters the opportunity to go to academics in their specific community and say, can you do a study on this community so we can not only arm people in multiple districts, but also give a lot more people a chance to contribute. So when I'm talking about having an effective relationship with elected officials, it's really looking to see how we can help them and resources that we can go and bring to bear to do that. Okay. So as I said, a lot of people have asked us to have Jerry Taylor on from Niskanen for quite some time. One of the things that I always wanted to know was, where did the name of this organization come from, Jerry being the president? And what we see is on the website it says, the center is named for William Bill Niskanen. Bill was a longtime friend whom we knew as chairman of the Cato Institute. Before his time at Cato, Bill was a defense policy analyst at RAND, director of program analysis at the Institute for Defense Analysis, assistant director of the Office of Management and Budget, professor of economics at the University of California at Berkeley, chief economist at the Ford Motor Company, professor of economics at UCLA, and member and later acting chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Ronald Reagan. Okay, impressive. But what we love more is what then they talk about, why name the organization after this particular guy. Bill is the personification of the qualities we embrace at the Niskanen Center. He was an exemplary scholar who never let ideology or partisanship color his interpretation of facts and data. He was an idealist, but at the same time a political realist with a burning desire to improve the state of affairs to whatever extent he could. And he was a man who earned great affection and respect from people across a wide range of governing networks in Washington. I think that for a lot of us on the call, that probably appeals to you as much as it appeals to me, is that this is the kind of organization that we're very happy to be working with and collaborating with. And, Jerry, thank you so much for making yourself available today.
Well, thank you, Mark, and thank you for that kind introduction. And I'm very flattered to be on the call and that all of you turned out this afternoon to hear a few thoughts from me on a day when you can be doing lots of other things. Mark asked me to talk about the conservative case for a carbon tax. It's a topic that I wrote quite a bit about at the Niskanen Center. I published a paper on that topic, which I know many of you are familiar with. I don't want to go through all of it. It would take too long. But the highlights of my argument is that there really is no conservative or liberal view of atmospheric physics. There is simply science. And the one thing that most of the scientists, even on the skeptic side of the argument, would accept is that there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty here. We know that when we put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we are going to warm the atmosphere. We're going to warm the planet. The issue is how much warming and how quickly will it come and what will the ramifications of that warming be. Virtually all, though not entirely all, but virtually all of the skeptical scientific community accepts that narrative. The question is, what are the chances, what are the risks, and what are the ceilings and floors of that warming? So it's really an issue of how to manage uncertainty and how to manage risk. Now, oftentimes, conservatives have this conceit that somehow liberals or people who respond with concern to climate change, they're extremely risk-averse, and conservatives know they're more risk-tolerant. And this really is a question of normative risk preference, and there's no right or wrong way to look at risk. And so for conservatives, it's, you know, either argument is fine, but since they're the chesty conservatives who are willing to roll dice in life and live the American ethos of aggression, and I don't mean aggression in a bad sense, but this is the normative position for conservatives. But the interesting thing to me is that there's really no conservative risk tolerance and liberal risk aversion. It really depends on what issue you're looking at. So we're looking at foreign policy, for instance. All of a sudden, the roles are switched. It's conservatives who are risk-averse, and it's liberals who become risk-tolerant. Right after 9/11, Vice President Dick Cheney said this, quote, if there is a 1% chance that a Pakistani scientist are helping al-Qaeda build or develop a nuclear weapon, we have to treat it as a certainty in terms of our response. That's pretty amazing to me. I mean, here we have an issue in foreign policy which isn't all that different from the issue we confront in climate change, managing a great deal of uncertainty about a potentially extremely significant problem. And when it comes to foreign policy, Dick Cheney would never entertain these risks. When it comes to the environment, he will entertain these risks. So why is it that conservatives and liberals oftentimes have different views about risk tolerance when it comes to climate? And I think the main reason is the implications of what needs to be done if we're going to address the problem. For conservatives, abandoning fossil fuels, which is the only real way to address climate over some period of time, is something that's virtually unimaginable to them. And so they look at the policy landscape and say, well, we're going to give up a resource that has built the modern world. They're afraid that giving it up means that we turn back into some sort of pastoral world like the Amish in Pennsylvania. For what? For the mere chance that something may or may not prove disastrous down the road, and they're not willing to roll those dice. So that's the problem that we confront when talking to conservatives. The policy response to climate change takes them in directions they don't want to go. They don't want to see regulation of the economy. They don't want to give up the wealth creation of fossil fuels. They don't want to expand government because only government can address this problem. And so for all these reasons, conservatives go down a different path. So the argument that I've taken, beyond just the scientific discussion, which I don't need to brief you on, you're all as aware as I am of the scientific issues surrounding climate change, is that for conservatives, if you look at this issue in any other dimension, there would be a case for action. If we were in financial markets, we would find these sorts of risks all the time. Now, of course, they're not quite as cataclysmic as the risk of climate change. But people, when they invest their own money, they don't invest and take wild chances. We may know, for instance, the most likely outcome in any given year is that you'll get more money investing in stocks than in anything else. That's the norm. But we also know there's a great deal of variability, and there's all sorts of other potential outcomes in a given year with regards to investment, and investing in stocks can be disastrous if you don't hedge. And so people do hedge. They hedge in financial markets. We hedge in foreign policy. It only makes sense to hedge when it comes to the climate. So for reminding conservatives of that argument is very important. And then, of course, there's also the more direct point, which is that if we are wrong about climate change and it turns out that it's not as big a risk as scientists believe it to be, then we can always kill the tax. We can always repeal it, or we can undo the regulations, or the government response can go in reverse. But if climate change does prove to be as deleterious as mainstream scientists think, then we can't very well undo the experiment we're conducting on the planet. Only geoengineering promises that, and that is a very iffy and dangerous road to take. Even my friend Pat Michaels at the Cato Institute, who's one of the most prominent scientific skeptics in the country, cautions against conservatives jumping into the geoengineering game, and he thinks that it is arguably as dangerous as anything else that we could run on the, as an experiment on the planet. So I think this is a very important point, that when we're looking at the future, we have to understand what the implications are of being wrong. And, of course, the implications of being wrong when it comes to the climate is absolute disaster. So when we get into these arguments with conservatives, when I do, oftentimes we get to this point of the conversation, and then we have a long, drawn-out argument about the costs and benefits of acting. Now, of course, the problem here is that not only is the science greatly uncertain, but so are the economic implications of action. That's even more uncertain. Economic models which try to demonstrate the costs of climate change and the costs of addressing climate change are even more uncertain and even more speculative than is a great deal of the scientific work. So we really can't say a great deal with authority here. But what I try to hammer home to my libertarianish conservative friends, and I still consider myself a libertarian, though maybe not in the popular sense of the word now as far as is defined by the libertarian movement, but the fact is that most libertarians, Tea Partiers, conservative Republicans, they argue that government's here for primarily one reason and one reason only. It's to protect our life, liberty, and property from trespass and violation from others. Well, that's exactly what's going on in greenhouse gas emissions. Greenhouse gas emissions are a violation of the rights to life, liberty, and property of the American people, in fact, the people all over the planet. And it's not enough to say, well, I guess Party A gets to harm Party B because Party A gains more than Party B loses. Conservatives would never embrace that argument. Libertarians would never embrace that argument in any other context. But when they get into a conversation of costs and benefits for addressing climate, that's exactly what they're doing. They're entertaining the idea that people should be allowed to violate the rights to life, liberty, and property of others simply because it makes them a good profit, and the costs of doing something about that violation are greater than the benefits. We would never entertain that conversation in any other context. So why do I embrace a carbon tax as a remedy as opposed to, say, the Clean Power Plan or other regulatory approaches? Well, simply because as an economically minded libertarian, I understand that prices are extremely powerful things. If we were to try to eliminate fossil fuels from the economy through regulatory fiat, it would be a tremendous undertaking. It would be very complicated with thousands of pages of rules and regulations, and it would ask bureaucrats and regulators to undertake a mission that they're very poorly equipped to undertake. If we put a price on carbon, that immediately affects the decision-making of market actors all over the United States, and if we had it globally all over the world, and it promises far greater and faster remedies to greenhouse gas emissions, anything else we can undertake. Now, of course, the issue is where we put the tax. I know you've probably heard a lot of conversations about where a tax needs to be to achieve the emissions reductions we want. The problem is, if you look at the economic models, even that's very uncertain. It depends on how we think technology is going to go and where do you think price elasticity is going to be for various fuels that haven't even been invented yet. So we really don't know for certain. The best we can tell is that if we want to get on a road of abandoning fossil fuels by the end of the century, which is what scientists believe we have to do, then we can get there with a carbon tax of around $35 a ton in today's terms, increasing by 4% a year up through 2050. That puts us on a path to eliminating half of the greenhouse gas emissions in the United States where we could go in that direction. I'm not sure if that sort of tax is passable in the United States Congress, but at least it gives you an idea of what's required to hit the baseline, but there are big margins of errors on both sides. That it may turn out the tax needs to be higher. It may turn out that if energy efficiency is as economically feasible and affordable as some would argue, and that renewable and clean energies are as competitive as many environmentalists think, then the tax would not have to be quite so high. But we'll have to see how that plays out. But even putting that aside, I think that a strong argument with conservatives is that even if you reject the science surrounding climate change, and even if you think that the chances of deleterious climate change are greatly overblown, the reality is we are regulating greenhouse gases now. We do have a carbon tax. Now, it's simply hidden within the cost of regulation. And it's virtually impossible to imagine a world in which the regulation being undertaken to address climate change is undone. It would take an incredible series of events, all of which would be challengeable in court, even if you saw Donald Trump go into the White House and try to repeal the endangerment finding at EPA, which unleashed the EPA regulation on climate change. That's subject to legal challenge. And when 97% of the peer-reviewed literature, which states a position on climate change, takes a position which is consistent with the EPA finding that greenhouse gases are indeed a danger to human health and welfare, it's very hard to imagine a judge ever letting that endangerment finding go away, absent a complete rewriting of the Clean Air Act, which, as long as there's 40 Democrats in the Senate, is never going to get past the filibuster. So the fact is, we are going to regulate greenhouse gases. We are regulating greenhouse gases now, and that cannot be unwound in any conceivable political universe that I live in. So for conservatives, the question is simply this. Would you rather regulate greenhouse gases in an expensive and efficient fashion, which is what we're doing with the Clean Power Plan, or which we're preparing to do with the Clean Power Plan, or would you rather use market mechanisms to address greenhouse gas emissions, which are far more efficient, far less costly, and far more effective at achieving the ends being advertised than are the regulations? Under that world, it seems amazing to me that conservatives continue to reject carbon taxes simply because they have this, in my opinion, a political fantasy about how someday the skeptics will be triumphant politically and rob the scientific community and mainstream understanding, and that we're on the cusp of completely reversing the regulatory attention around the greenhouse gases, which I find is absolutely implausible. But until conservatives are disabused of that fantasy, I have a feeling we're going to have quite a slog in front of us. Anyway, Mark, you only asked me for about 10 minutes, and I'm sure I've used pretty much all of that up, though there's a lot I didn't address, so let me just open it up for questions. And
let me just start with a couple of the ones that were asked most frequently. So our people in Alaska and a bunch of other chapters said, you know, the Alaska Permanent Fund is very popular. You know, it's obvious to people when they get a check. One of the reasons that we've always been in favor of people actually getting a dividend is we thought it'd be the easiest way to maintain political support because people would see a check coming into their account. You know, I live in California. We have AB 32, which is a cap and trade law, And people get a credit on their electricity bill a couple times a year, but nobody knows it. So there was a huge opportunity of political will being generated that was missed by people not actually seeing a check. Secretary Shultz says the reason he's in favor of that is it's the hardest to rig, most transparent solution. I think, like a lot of conservatives who view this issue, you think a tax swap would be preferable. And could you just talk a little bit about why you prefer the tax swap over the dividend?
I don't necessarily prefer the tax swap over the dividend. My main interest is putting a price on carbon that is sufficient enough to reduce the risk of catastrophic climate change to the greatest extent possible. Period, full stop, and end of story. What we do with the revenue is a secondary and lesser important question to me. The main insight here is that the revenue that is derived from a carbon tax will be used to buy support for the carbon tax in Congress. That's how a carbon tax is going to happen. Now, what is the right allocation of carbon tax revenues to unlock the votes necessary to pass a carbon tax? I don't know. I think that the argument that is forwarded by CCL for a rebate is very compelling, and I agree with Secretary Shultz. It seems like a very airtight way of addressing conservative concerns that, one, this tax will impoverish the American people. No, it won't. The monies go back to the American people. So, now, of course, it'll be lumpy. Some people will pay more in taxes than they get in return in the rebate, but two-thirds of the people or so will get more in the rebate than they pay in the tax. So, you know, that addresses a very important concern very nicely. And secondly, it also addresses conservative concerns about the growth of government. If the revenue never gets to the Treasury in the first place, it can't be spent. So I find it a very compelling argument. But in Washington, compelling arguments a quarter buy you a cup of coffee. There are a lot of compelling arguments out there that don't get the time of day here in town. So the real issue is, what organized constituencies can you mobilize in support of a carbon tax with this, that, or the other allocation of capital? So a lot of the people I talk to in Washington, they're in favor of, you know, using the revenue to offset cuts in corporate income taxes or things like that, because they believe that's the key to getting the business community behind the tax. And if you don't get the business community behind a carbon tax, then you are in deep trouble politically, because they have a lot of pull in the GOP and even in some parts of the Democratic Party as well. So you need to build constituencies for the tax. And so I'm in favor of however that allocation goes. I'm in favor of using it in a way that gets us a bill. And if a rebate is the key to getting that bill, fine with me. If a offsetting tax cut is the key for getting that getting a price on carbon, fine with me too.
Great. Okay. Which kind of leads into another question I had is, we have a team inside the organization called the Endorser Team, and what they do is support the groups throughout the country, getting people to sign letters of endorsement, either just saying we need to take action on climate change or supporting our specific proposal. And I'm interested in your input on who you think the highest leverage type of people we could reach out to. Now, some of our chapters, I think, have done some really remarkable things. In Lehigh, Pennsylvania, they joined their local chamber of commerce. They had someone who was a former gas executive who joined their energy and environment committee. So it wasn't like somebody from the outside trying to get them to do something. It's, you know, now joining the chamber and then seeing if we can work on the chamber to get them to endorse what we're doing. Similarly, there's been really remarkable work with our Wisconsin group in Rotary, trying to do an enormous amount of outreach in Rotary. But who are the kinds of organizations, and can you give us some guidance on how we might reach out to significant individuals and organizations that would particularly provide support on the GOP side?
Well, on the Republican side of the aisle, electric utility companies are hugely influential at the state level, and they do have a great deal of power in Washington as well. And since they're the main entities that are wrestling with climate issues, if they were to support a carbon tax as preferable to, say, regulatory undertakings at EPA, that would be a major step. We've already seen that big oil, quote-unquote, is at least in theory in favor of carbon pricing. Now, of course, we haven't seen any specific proposals from ExxonMobil. But if you look at the statements of CEOs and the websites, you see a general agreement that carbon pricing is a way to go in addressing climate change, and generally a concession to climate change is a real problem that has to be addressed. So that's something. So energy companies are important. If energy companies endorse a carbon tax, that's three-quarters of the fight right there. So that's an obvious one. But one thing that I've noticed in American politics is that people follow leaders. Let me give you an example of something that I found incredibly interesting. There was a survey done recently in which Republican activists were asked their opinion on single-payer health care, and only 16% of them supported single-payer health care. Of course, this shouldn't surprise opposition to expansion of government control of health care under the Affordable Care Act has been the bloody shirt of right-wing politics for, you know, for the entirety of the Obama administration. But when they were told that Donald Trump supports single-payer, the numbers went to 44%. So what this tells you is that people on the right, just like people on the left and elsewhere, are far less ideological and entrenched in their views than you might think. They tend to be rather tribal in nature, and they support the position of the tribe. So if they like Donald Trump, then they're willing to even abandon something like opposition to single-payer health care, even in the GOP, even amongst Tea Party members. That's amazing to me, and that gives you an idea of the direction we need to go. We need to convince opinion leaders on the right. That's the main challenge. If opinion leaders on the right were to embrace carbon taxation, I think you would see a rapid shift. So if the people on Fox News started talking about this in a positive fashion, it would be a very significant thing. So that'd be my piece of advice on where to go.
Okay, that's phenomenal. And then the last one I think is probably pretty straightforward, but I had quite a few people ask me if a carbon tax were put in place, would you be in favor of eliminating all energy subsidies?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, when I was at the Cato Institute, even before I switched positions, I mean, for 20-odd years, I argued against government federal action to address greenhouse gas emissions. But even under that time at the Cato Institute, I argued for zeroing out energy subsidies across the board. In fact, I'll tell you a little story. About 15 years ago, I was in CNN Green Room going on TV, and in the room with me was Carl Pope, who was the president of the Sierra Club. And we started chatting, and it turned out that Carl tells me that he's in favor of eliminating energy subsidies across the board. And I said, well, that's remarkable. I never would have guessed that from Sierra Club. And he says, well, of course. He said, green energy is disadvantaged in the tax code, and more subsidies are going to nuclear and, you know, other forms of energy that are going to clean energy. So let's just zero it out and let the best fuel win. I'm pretty confident clean energy would win in a level playing field. So anyway, we agreed to work together, and even though the Cato Institute doesn't lobby for a living, we gave all as much intellectual support to the Sierra Club as we could, and gave them some advice on where to go on the Hill to find Republican supporters of a bill. And their plan was to actually get this thing introduced and work it and not just, you know, make some statement of support and leave it at that. They were really going to move the bill. They couldn't find a single Republican to move that bill. Even my friend Jeff Flake, who is a libertarian-minded senator now from Arizona, then he was a congressman, wouldn't touch it. I mean, he thought about it, but he wouldn't introduce the bill. I was on a panel shortly thereafter with Denny Hastert when he was Speaker of the House, and Hastert thundered against the idea of zeroing out energy subsidies. So it's just amazing to me that Republicans, when they talk about the evils of government intervention in the economy, you know, everywhere else, but when it comes to energy, all of a sudden, no, government needs to be involved, and it needs to be picking winners, and it needs to have, you know, 5-year, 10-year, 20-year energy plans, and it needs to subsidize coal and nuclear and wind energy and solar. I mean, and the real debate in Washington is to what extent we're going to pull levers and throw help to this, that, or the other energy lobbyist. It's a terrible situation. So, yeah, in an ideal world, with a carbon tax is going to come a lot of other things with that bill, and zeroing out all subsidies, green and brown, would be a wonderful thing.
Great. Well, for anybody who's not following your organization, I recommend that you do. They are regularly putting out papers that I find very, very clear, very fresh, and useful, both on things I've read both on the U.S. and Canada recently. I thought that was a good piece also. So thank you for your extraordinary work, and the we loved watching that your organization get built, and look forward to working with you as we go along here. Thank you so much, Jerry.
Well, thank you, Mark. We enjoy working with you and look forward to doing more of the same down the road.
Okay. Thanks again for making yourself available on a Saturday. Really appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Okay. Well, for all the people who recommended we get Jerry on the call, thank you for the suggestion. I mean, I've been a big fan, but it was great, and thank you for pushing me on that. Okay. So I do want to go over a few things that happened since last month's call. So first of all, Canada got an editorial from the Globe and Mail. That is really, really large. That would be like the Wall Street Journal doing something in the U.S., so fantastic. Last month, we had 241 letters to the editor published. So that is the second highest total this month, and this year, and one of the most highest totals ever, which I was stunned. Given how many people take time off in August and, you know, people kind of get in summer mode, that many people were reaching out and submitting and getting published is absolutely remarkable. I do want to give a little bit of shout-out that some of the people who are publishing letters are starting to target communities where we don't have groups. So one of the ways they're introducing those communities to CCL is by publishing in papers where we don't have groups. And for those of you who did that, thank you so much. That was fantastic. We had 15 TV appearances this month. We have had 10 TV appearances the whole year. We had 15 television appearances. I have no idea where that came from, but 15 television appearances is amazing. We just finished up the Australian first ever conference. They'll be lobbying Parliament, I think it's already Monday there, for the next 2 days. So congratulations to all of you from Australia who will be listening to the recording. We also have this week Grandparents Day, where we trained people from the Conscious Elder Network on carbon fee and dividend. There were 100 people in Washington, D.C. this week. They were up lobbying on the Hill, and they also did a very fun, flash mobs in Metro Station. It was great. I'm sure we'll get that circulated out to everybody. Our people in Texas are just doing ridiculously great things. They've organized the Texas Freedom Tour, which is going to visit 30 cities in October, or close to 30 cities. For everybody who's been involved in making that happen, again, Texas is obviously a state that we feel that we need to be very, very much organized in, and that for the people who have done that work and the people who will be going out making those presentations, that is just phenomenal. I want to mention the Endorsers Project again. So the Endorsers team is a team of people who are supporting the rest of us in getting endorsements from people of influence and businesses. So they're not actually out there trying to get the endorsements. What they're trying to do is give you and I the tools to make that happen. So for Kim, Peter, the people on that team, thank you for the great work you're doing there. Also, if you're going to the Parliament of the Religions in October in Salt Lake City, that's going to be a huge gathering of religious leaders. If you get a chance, please coordinate with Bill Barron or anybody in the Salt Lake chapter, because we want to stay as organized as possible for that. Okay. If you were one of the additional 10,000 things that were sent in to me saying you can please mention this, I'm sorry, I just can't get to everything every month. There's a lot of great stuff happening out there, everybody. I do want to mention a couple things that will be coming up one very soon and one a little bit. This week, we will be handing out copies of the encyclical to a printed copy to every member of the House and Senate starting this Wednesday. So we are going to be handing those out, and we wrote a very simple note that doesn't ask anything of Congress. The approach we're taking with this is, and this is basically what the note says, is we expect that in advance of and after the Pope's visit on the 24th, you're going to get asked questions. And we want to make sure that you're armed as well as you can possibly be to answer those. So we're putting a copy in every single office. We're hoping as many members of Congress as possible get to read it. And again, we're not trying to do this asking them to do something for us. We're trying to do this to be in service of Congress and to help them do their job and make sure they're not caught off guard based on what somebody else said about what the Pope actually wrote and actually be able to read what the Pope wrote. And I'm excited that our team in D.C. is getting that all out, so thank you all for that. This November, we're also going to be having a targeted lobby day. So what we did last year is after the June conference, we distilled all the information from the meeting minutes and distilled it into a report, and in November, we went back to targeted committees and walked through with them what we found. So essentially, where is Congress with respect to dealing with the problem of solving climate change? And we targeted four committees, and we're going to target those four committees again, which is in the House, the committees our legislation would have to go through, Ways and Means and Energy and Commerce, and in the Senate, Finance and Energy and Natural Resources. So if you're a liaison for one of those committees, next week you're going to get a note about the scheduling process of getting as many appointments scheduled with those people as possible. If you're a liaison and you are not one of those committees, you can still schedule an appointment during lobby day. And if it works for you, if it's not a burden for you on your time or finances to come to Washington on November the 16th and 17th, you're certainly welcome to come. The Lobby Day is a way different phenomena than our national conference. I think every year when the conference comes up, you should do everything in your wherewithal to get everybody to come, not only because of the influence that it has on Washington, D.C., but I think that there's nothing that we do that puts more wind in all of our sails. For me, most years, it's almost a transformative experience where I feel like I'm a different person on the other side of it. So with the national conference, I think you should do whatever you need to do to get there. That's not the case with Lobby Day. So we're going to target these four committees, but we're certainly going to house appointments, including if you don't want to come, say, from California or Washington, or just doesn't work for you, or it's not cost, doesn't make sense, you can call in. For some of those meetings, we were able to do it in last year's Lobby Day. Not all offices let us do it, but some did. So again, this isn't something we're trying to convince a bunch of people they should come to, but if it works for you financially, if it doesn't, it isn't hard for you on your time, then we're certainly welcome to be here. We're going to do a day of training on the 16th of November. We're going to go on Capitol Hill on the 17th of November. And then on the 18th, we're going to try a new experiment called NGO Day. Now, this isn't NGO Day like where we would go see the Sierra Club or Jerry Taylor, you know, organizations that we've been reaching out to on a regular basis. This is an NGO day based on some organization you might have a relationship with. So let's say you're a social worker, or you're a nurse, or you're a teacher, and there's an association that you could meet with on that Wednesday and talk to them about carbon fee and dividend. That's what we mean by NGO day. So the NGO day with this November 16th, 17th, and then 18th for the Lobby Day would be organized around NGOs that, let's say you're a teacher, and there's some teachers association you could meet with. There is information on the website. About the middle of our website has the information. If you want to come, there is a registration fee of $25 that helps to cover the cost of lunch that is included. So anyway, for those of you who it works, we'd love to see you in November, but please don't feel any obligation to have to come. Okay, dokey. All right, so I want to go over the Canadian actions, the U.S. actions, and then I have an announcement that I'm kind of excited about that I want to share with you at the end of today's call also. So first of all, let's start with the Canadian actions. Kathy, could you unmute your phone for a second?
Yes. Is the sound on my phone okay?
Yeah, sound on your phone is great. And first of all, I believe that this is the fifth year anniversary of CCL in Canada. Do I have that right?
Well, yes, Mark, thanks for remembering. Yeah, it was in September of 2010, a Canadian sat on the monthly National Citizens Climate Lobby call, and you guys became an international group.
Wow, and we were hoping not to, so it happened anyway.
Well, I'm sure glad Marshall thought I was an American. His vision of bringing Sam Daly's Harris models of citizen engagement over to the climate movement and was desperately needed. And I know Canada is very grateful for all you have shared with us. And for me personally, you've been a cure for my climate trauma.
Okay, great. And so what are we doing in September in Canada?
Well, in September, our actions are for September and October this month. Firstly, CCL Ontario has an upcoming training and lobbying days on October 4th and October 5th. And as for our actions this month, we are approaching them quite differently because we have brand new groups, people who haven't even been trained, joined on this summer, and we have very seasoned groups. And we also have a federal election in about 6 weeks. So this month's actions are for both September and October. And we are asking our volunteers to select the best actions that speak specifically to their group's skill sets and capacity. The actions fall under three categories. Use social media to amplify CCL's messages of truth and hope, and the specifics are in the action sheets. Work with your local mainstream media. Again, look for the details in the action sheets. And finally, this last one's unique and fun. We did it recently in a by-election. Be an investigative reporter. Determine local candidates' views on climate change and carbon pricing, and then submit your findings to your local papers. So, again,
great.
Do what you and your group can reasonably do and what rocks your boat. Have fun out there.
Okay, and now, Kathy, I just want to say that I know Canada's in the middle of its longest election cycle ever, 11 weeks. Oh, my God. How what we would do to have one of those election cycles in the U.S.? Anyway, great work, Kathy. Look forward to everything that's going to happen up there, particularly between now and the October election.
Thanks, Mark.
Yep, okay. All right, good. So in the U.S., it's all the Pope all the time. We're going to ask you to generate letters to the editor and editorials and op-eds in conjunction with the Pope's visit. We're also going to ask you to write to your member of Congress about the Pope coming. So it's all Pope all the time. That's all the way until Thursday. We do want you to keep it up. But this has been a bit of a strange month. We've had two action sheets that we've been working on because for about 9 months we've been working with a Republican office on introducing a resolution saying that climate change is essentially real and we need to do something about it. We thought that that was going to come out this Thursday, but apparently the leadership asked him to push it back because they wanted to get the vote on Iran through. We're pretty certain that it will happen next Thursday. So in addition to the action sheet you're looking at today, you should expect another action sheet from us on Thursday, and we're pretty confident about that. What we expect will happen on Thursday is there will be a resolution introduced saying essentially this is a real problem, we need to do something about it, and like what the Pope is saying, we need to have a dialogue. We expect that there will be a few Republican co-sponsors at that time, and what we're going to ask our organization to do is to reach out and get as many Republican co-sponsors as we quickly possibly can on that resolution. So what we want you to do is go to work immediately on the actions we've listed with respect to the Pope. When the second action sheet arrives on Thursday, if it does, what we would like is every office in a Republican district. This is going to be a House resolution only at this point. We do not have a companion item in the Senate yet, but we do want to show that there is enough support for dealing with the issue first on the Republican side of the aisle, that then the second step would be about some type of pricing mechanism. So at any rate, a little different month than usual, clear cut about what you're supposed to do right now, but there's a chance that will change on Thursday, and that's a good chance it will change. All right, everybody, thank you so much for all you're doing. The amount of activity that came in between things getting published, radio interviews, meetings, et cetera, was remarkable this month. I'm going to unmute the phone so you can just say goodbye and thank everybody here.
All guests have been unmuted.
Bye. Later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm going to hang this thing up.
Meeting that happens.